Welcome back to Take Me Into the Ball Game.
Part two.
It's perfect to have a part two for a part two kind of a movie.
Yeah, double deuce. That's probably not the best way of putting it. Welcome back.
Yeah, welcome back, everybody. So just moving right along from that, the first thing that we are going to be talking about in this half of the podcast is storytelling.
So this movie is so weird.
Yes.
And it's so interesting.
Yes.
And it's so of its time. Like it's mm-hmm. like fast, just like what it is so fascinating. And like some of the Eisner stuff I mentioned in the introduction and kind of like referencing the Newt Rockne stuff and giving some context about that is like part of it. But it's funny because some of this almost feels like the great strength of this film, and also where some of the weaknesses are, is that it is narratively such a jumble of tropes. Like it is part after school special. It is part road movie.
Mm-hmm.
It is part sports movie. It uses like all of these different character types. You've got like Kelly Leak being this like who Carmen is like the last of the Lone Eagles, James Dean, Charles Lindbergh, weird, and like Kelly Leak. You've got one of the first moments of Kelly Leak revving the engine of the dirt bike against the like almost going to be like coach who's a militant jerk who needs to get out of there, who they kick out, by saying, "You talking to me?" Like a clear reference to Travis Bickle in Taxi Driver, which had come out not that long before. The whole character of Carmen plays on this like Italian guy from the city thing that was like all over 70s like TV stuff.
Totally.
Right? Like
yep.
This character comes from the same place that like Fonzie and Chachi and Vinnie Barbarino and all of those dudes like come out of. Like it is such a snapshot of a particular time, and that in and of itself is so fascinating and so awesome and makes me constantly while I'm watching this movie be like, does this movie kick ass? But also a lot of those things aren't like direct intentional storytelling. It's like, what an amazing like relic of this period. What an amazing snapshot. And it doesn't fully work, but there's something about all of these things coming into play, all of the like commercial stuff that like, you know, I mean, that kind of stuff has always been around, but like it's so blatant with the Kentucky Fried Chicken and the Hilton
Budweiser.
And the Budweiser. Like there's something about it all that just feels so like late 70s jaded, and you can see the road to the present day already being like rolled out, that like, I don't know. I don't know that this movie is great, but I kind of love it.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is something that like we talked a little bit about with Bad News Bears, the original, specifically in terms of like the treatment of childhood, that I was like, it really feels like it is showing something that is in between the childhood that we experienced, which was a little bit more focused on safety and wasn't just like 13 kids riding on the back of a convertible
right,
down the highway, but not quite to the degree of the way that I think it is, not just for kids today, but maybe even literally like the generation after us, in terms of the amount of freedom, in terms of kind of just like the scrapes that kids were allowed to get in.
Yeah.
And I think also, like, it has to be said, and I think it's boring to harp on this too much, but like the racism and
sure.
and the misogyny and the fat phobia and all that kind of stuff, like it's a picture of that as well, where you're like, oh yeah, it was different, just like what we even expected
yeah
about behavior was different.
Yeah.
Not just kind of like, oh, look at these, you know, look at Mike Leake wearing his bell-bottom pants, you know what I mean, as like a serious adult at right. the Astrodome.
Right.
Just like an entirely different way of looking at being a human and relating to other humans.
Yeah. And I think that also within all of this and within this pastiche of 70s tropes where it's like, oh, we've got some Easy Rider stuff happening. We've got Kelly Leake doing like some Evel Knievel moves. He's gotten better on that motorcycle or dirt bike or whatever in the time, but you know, in this year that's passed, there is so much fantasy at work. This is a movie that the first, like, almost half of it, basically until they get nabbed by Officer Mackey, it's a movie of kids, like, getting away with stuff. You're like, watching them, like, the mean coach who starts the movie, and he's, like, he's got a chalkboard for some reason on the right outside the diamond, like, up on the fence, and he does the, like, assume is, you know, makes an ass out of you and me. And then he's, like, about to write the word discipline down before Kelly comes up. And when he gets ousted, when he gets shamefully spurned by his team, he's like, you know, good luck getting to Houston without a coach. So it's like a gauntlet thrown down. And the kids, they figure it out. They maneuver past so many adults in the act of getting here. And it is such a, like, such a explosion of this childhood sense of, like, freedom and, like, being able to, like, outsmart the authoritarian adults in your lives that wanna tie you down and keep you from that American dream of the road. Like, it's like a kid's road movie for, like, the first half of it.
Yeah. I wanted to say about the Mr. Manning moment. It is strange that for when he makes that sort of really basic dad joke about if you assume you make an ass out of you and me, that Engelberg's response is, was he sent from Hitler? And I was like, are you saying that, like, basic dad jokes were part of Hitler's type five? Like, was Hitler known for coming to power by greeting every hungry German who was like, I'm hungry, by being like, hi, hungry, I'm Hitler. You know, like, did he...
Boy, I hope not.
Did he come over to the SS like, hey, working hard or hardly working? Anyway.
Yeah, no, I think that we're just, you know, obviously supposed to take him as like, oh, look at this disciplinarian who's come in. There's that same vibe when we first see the Toros. It's the same kind of like drill sergeant, do your like calisthenics in a straight line sort of thing. Side note, Coach Manning, his little like coach's outfit, he's wearing the number 42.
I noticed that also.
Very weird.
Yes. Yeah. I was like, that's a choice.
That is a choice.
That's a choice at this point. Like, yeah.
What was that about?
Obviously, he's bad news when he wants to call Ahmad Andy.
Yeah.
That was when the Hitler line should have gone.
It's true.
It was weird that his pronunciation of like the Latino kids' names was actually like the best of anybody in the film. And then he couldn't call Ahmad Andy. It was sort of, I don't know.
It's weird. There are some things in this movie where you get the sense that they put it in because they were like, they're the bad news bears. That's like, there's got to be a thing here. Because going back to the sort of like racism, the general like insensitivity of people who are other from oneself. There's the kind of like famous Tanner thing in the first one where he's like, you know, we've got a team full of like blank, 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 and blank, you know, yes. Just sort of like really, really like leaning into like a kind of like bigoted way of talking.
Yeah.
And when Carmen, the new pitcher, shows up, he does it again, but like adding one special for the Italian kid. And like, I'm not saying that it's like wonderful when it happens in the first movie, but it makes a sort of sense that it doesn't really in this one when the rest of the people are like his teammates who he cares about now.
Yeah, it was, it just sort of felt like they were like, well, part of the winning formula of the first movie was that Tanner has to be racist. So just like, we got to have that again for all the people who are like fans of the little racist blonde kid.
Yeah, he's got a filthy mouth, but he fights hard. You know, he's Lenny Dykstra.
I mean, how could you do Lenny Dykstra dirty that way?
Like,
I don't know.
Like, man, this guy's a jerk, but like, what a heart. He plays with so much heart.
Yeah. I mean, perhaps to this question of Tanner's character development, is that why Lupus has to have a broken leg?
Like, so weird.
Or was it like his team was asking for too high of a daily rate? Man. And being like, you can't make this sequel without young Quinn Smith, and now we want a better deal for him to come back to the second film, see? And the producing team was like, fine, we're just going to write you down to one day.
I feel like they very intentionally were leaning into, like, again, another like slightly after school special thing, but maybe more so the sports movie like deathbed trope, or, you know, the kind of like the Newt Rockne thing, you know, Win One for the Looper, which Tanner gives a variation of the Newt Rockne Win One for the Gipper speech before the final game. But it's so funny that it does this kind of like Johnny Sylvester
totally
like, on the deathbed thing. He broke his leg skateboarding.
Yeah, which is very metal, by the way, for that like adorable blonde booger machine,
yeah,
right?
Like, accidentally caught a ball every now and then.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So he broke his leg skateboarding, and suddenly he's lying in bed like he's got polio and like a 102 degree fever.
Yeah, and these soulful postcards narrated and written by Tanner getting sent several times over the course of the film. Like, it is
like he might die.
Like,
right?
He might die. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Unless they win that game.
Unless they win that game. Yeah. I did also note in that scene the present of the autographed ball that they get for Lupus has the movie trick that Mike Schur hates of the top of the box being wrapped separately from the bottom.
I did appreciate Looper's room being very baseball equal opportunity. There were lots of pennants on the walls from different teams, from different leagues. And I don't know if you noticed, but it sure seemed to me like the most prominent object in that room was a big old poster of Mr. Mike Schmidt.
You know what? I didn't notice that, and probably just because I was like, yep. You know what I mean? Like, yeah, like that's what a kid would have, like, obviously.
I had, yeah. I was like, is that Mike Schmidt? And I like paused it and I was like, you can't really see a Phillies logo. The definition is not so good that you can clearly see his face where I was watching it. But I was like, that looks like a number 20. And that's Mike Schmidt. So way to go, Looper.
Yeah. Yeah. And I was just like, this background checks out. That makes sense. Yeah.
Kindred spirit.
That was the scene where I was like, this editing. There's a lot of very long, lingering reaction shots.
Yeah. Where you're like, this should have cut to the next thing like 2 seconds
ago. 2 seconds ago. Yeah, like, is something else going to happen?
Yeah.
Sometimes it's a little creepy.
And I think that is part of what gives it a little bit of a like made-for-TV film vibe, which I think is also like clearly a result of the fact that this got fast-tracked and like, you know, I don't think that they spent a lot of time getting everything just right. And that probably includes the cutting of it. But yeah, there are these weird lingering like reaction shots or like emotional shots where it's like you can have that moment and have it be like multiple seconds shorter. It happens more than once in the film.
It happens so often that it felt like maybe a stylistic choice for me. Yeah.
Yeah.
So in regards to their scheme to get a fake coach so that they can take to the road themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Am I the only person who felt a little sorry for Mr. Eastland when the van pulls away and he's all by himself again? Like, having...
He got all dressed up?
having just been taught to say, hello, how are you? And I was also kind of like, if all it took was Kelly Leak teaching him to say, hello, how are you, in the shed for an hour, what kind of speech therapy was he given for the rest of his life?
Yeah. You know what? I'll be honest. I was mostly caught up in thinking, this poor groundskeeper who cannot speak very well, apparently, and is clearly like not the sharpest knife in the drawer, he's got a pretty nice house. I was like, he seems to be doing okay for himself, actually. I was happy for him.
Yeah, in that's that respect. Nice. Yeah. No, I didn't think about it. I just feel like there are a lot of holes to this part of the storyline.
Yeah, and it is one of the things that you're kind of like, really? Like, none of the parents had a follow-up question?
Right.
And like, the kids are piling into the custom van.
Yes.
Even as some of the parents have not yet fully left.
Yes. Yes. And like, you also think that it would have been a lot easier for the kids if Mr. Eastland had come along in the van.
Yeah.
Like, you wouldn't have to pretend that your parents were burn victims. I doubt that Mr. Eastland actually would have, like, gotten in the way of you having a fun time.
Yeah. I guess you could, like, you could figure out a way to have him be, like, missing work or whatever, but, like...
Yeah.
Part of it is, maybe you were about to say, the thrill of the kids, like, getting away with it and being on their own.
Totally. That's what the movie wants, but I just didn't quite buy it. But that van is sick, though.
Yeah, and I do like... There is something, like, fun about that moment where it's, like, the exhilaration of these kids being out on their own and having, like, figured out how to make it work. And then, like, the disguise when the cop comes up and Kelly puts on, like, a hat and he looks kind of like Spike from Peanuts, like Snoopy's cousin that lives out in the desert.
He does, actually. He does.
Like, that's not a joke. He looks remarkably like Spike.
He looks remarkably like Spike. Yeah. Do you think that he specifically brought that hat in order to make himself look more adult while driving, if necessary?
Maybe, unless it just happened to be in, like, belong to whoever the van belongs to or whatever.
Oh, yeah.
But in either case, it's a quick thinking on his part.
I mean, it only really works in the fiction of this movie. It does not make him look any older than he is.
No, it really doesn't.
Although I did look up, and interestingly, Haley himself would have been 16 when the film came out.
Yeah, and he's supposed to be 13.
Yeah. Yeah, which is, you know, classic casting.
Yeah, yeah,
but, like, somebody who looks like that could drive. Maybe not a van, but...
The scene where they're all... This is before they hit the road there, and before they leave. There's a kind of montage of them all asking their parents for money, which I thought was, like, kind of interesting and sort of funny.
Yeah.
And, like... You know, some of them ask for a little bit, some of them ask for a lot. There could be any number of ways to sort of interpret the why of it, like anything from...
It definitely seems like Engelberg's house is the fanciest. So him asking for a lot of money isn't just like he's planning on eating a lot of food, although of course that's like...
That seems like part of it.
The one drum that this film keeps banging for that particular character.
The first thing that we see, like, of him is that... He's huffing his way to practice and immediately pulls out 6 full-size Hershey bars. Like, presumably not to share.
Oh, God. It's just, it's one of those things where, you know, so often I'm like, the 2020s, what a terrible time to be alive. And then there are moments where I'm like, at least there's less fat phobia.
Yeah.
But I did feel like his house was also the fanciest. I felt like they were trying to tell that story a little bit, right? Like, the kids who ask for, like, $20 or $25 feels the most, like, obviously middle class, you know? And the supposed punchline of, I think it's Jose asking for $4 for both of them.
Right. Yeah.
in English all of a sudden, for some reason, in the middle of the scene. Everybody else has been speaking Spanish, and then suddenly $4 for both of us in English. Not that I don't assume that, you know, most of the people in the family are bilingual, but yeah.
I do kind of like it, though, because I think it's like a fun kind of like collective ruse in action. Like, it sort of feels like they're all a part of this big plan. It's not just, oh, Kelly, the leader, has this idea, which is like kind of part of it, but like everybody needs to do their part to execute it. I did sort of enjoy. And I think it does kind of like tie into the idea of them like working as a team, even when they are in need of some baseball brush up.
Yes. Yeah, that's fair.
Similarly, I think storytelling wise, Carmen is a really cool device to solve
100%
the we need a new pitcher problem.
Yep.
Because we no longer have Tatum O'Neill, and that would have been really, really great. But in the absence of a Tatum O'Neill, who better than an overcompensating, cocky, confident person masking his deep insecurity that he's not actually going to fill the position as well as expected? Like, the role echoes out to the context of the production so much in
oh,
that regard,
yeah.
in a
yeah,
way that I just think
smart.
Is like really, really cool. It's like, I like lacking the skill that the impression is trying to give. And it's like, yeah, he's great, but he can't bring what Tatum O'Neill brought to the table. And so in a weird way, it's like the perfect solution to that problem.
Yeah, and a perfect metaphor. And the idea of like, oh, we'll emulate the thing that seemed to have worked.
Right, right. And I wonder if that might partially be the reason why Catfish Hunter is one of the people that he's imitating. Because I think Walter Matthau, I think Buttermaker kind of jokingly calls Amanda Catfish Hunter
when she's making all kinds of
demands
because
yeah.
of Catfish Hunter being the first sort of like free agent. Yeah.
Yeah. So I think that's some smart writing.
Yeah, I agree. The first time that we saw this, when they meet the native kids in the parking lot and play a baseball game, I think I said aloud, oh, they're going to get creamed. And I think it was just structural awareness more than anything else.
Mm-hmm.
But I have to say, I really like this scene being in the movie.
Oh, I love it.
Yeah. I hate that it is bookended with casual racism, the peace pipe joke, and then the even worse, we've been scalped joke. Terrible.
Yeah.
But I'm glad that the scene is in the movie. But it is complicated because it's kind of like Ahmad's obsession with the police. It's not inaccurate to introduce the native characters like looking through the window of the van and being sort of envious of the bear's uniform and equipment and the idea that the irregularity of the field where they play, that like these are the resources that they have,
mm-hmm.
right? It's comedically tuned up. But I think that that's like, it's a good point to make, but it's also complicated when it's sort of the subject of comedy.
Right.
Right? And, you know, I mean, I think it's also useful in a storytelling way that it is like an extreme home field advantage with all of these sort of rocks and extreme irregularities in their playing field. It's kind of like a creative way to have the Bears be extra unlucky in that game.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So it's not just that they're bad, although they are also a little bad. They're actually worse in the practice,
mm-hmm.
right? They just are, they're extremely babbipped to death by their environment. And like, this is a feature of baseball, you know, like the Red Sox left fielder is at an advantage for knowing how to play the monster, and outfielders at Old Crosley Field knew how to deal with a terrace that like sloped up in the outfield. Visitors were more likely to trip. But yeah, it's just, it's like, it feels in some way like it encapsulates not everything, but a lot of things in this movie that I'm like, I like this scene and I'm really glad that it's here, but it's complicated when the characters are defined by their racial injustices or kind of like the shot when the native kids are all like angry and stalking towards Carmen because he hit a batter.
Yeah. And some of this is also just done in part with the absence of things. Like, Ahmad is a little bit more problematic of a character in this movie than in the first one.
Mm-hmm. Strong agree.
And part of that is because in the absence of something similar to the scene in the first movie where he climbs the tree and he's got that like kind of really sweet scene with Buttermaker, there's just a lot of stuff that just kind of reads as like, what would a black kid say? So he's just like saying over and over again, like, we're going to the joint. And like when he hits that stand-up triple in the game, he does like a Muhammad Ali 100%. Like riff. And it just feels like, especially because there isn't anything really substantial other than that, it just reads as stereotype.
Yep. I sort of feel like there's this moment in the scene where they're at the hotel where there's this 1-2 punch of Engelberg asking about lunch and Ahmad making like his 12th reference to going to the joint. And I was like, this is everything that is wrong with this movie.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And it's not like the stuff with Ahmad. I don't want to like go overboard with the stuff with Ahmad because it's like one of the lesser offenders, I think, in this film, but it is still like present and it like lets you know that it is intentional.
And the thing about it is that it's just not creative or developed, right? Yeah. Like obviously it is to us in 2020, it's offensive, but then like it's just they just keep on making the same joke for every character. Well, not for every character, but like for a number of the characters again and again and again. And it's just like, have something else about them. Right? Yeah. Like, that just feels like good storytelling to not have one thing about a character, whether or not that happens to be something that is about their literal body or not.
And
right?
To be fair, like, some of this extends also to Carmen. Like, there are so many Italian stereotypes, like, packed up into that character. But also, it's a full enough character, and he's got, like, this internal struggle. He's got, like, all this other stuff going on that it doesn't hit quite the same way, even though he knows a guy who can get a van and he like came across these Playboys, which you don't see him buy. And he's got this kind of like East Coast Italian bravado to him that is 100% based in stereotypes.
Yeah.
But there is a spectrum of offenses and offenders here, but it does sort of seem like there is some kind of prejudicial shorthand for a lot of people within the movie.
And I think that's one of the things that makes something like Tanner using the most offensive epithets for all of his teammates more troubling than just the idea of like, oh, the joke is that this is a like an adorable little blonde kid who just happens to have a foul mouth and have all of these terrible ideas, when it's actually sort of this microcosm for the view of the human beings. More charitable than that, obviously, but that it is also kind of based on stereotypes and tropes. You're kind of like, oh, yeah, that's gross.
Yeah, well, and like William Devane's Mike Leake, you know, he seems like a pretty decent guy. Like, we get allusions to him leaving Kelly and the trauma there. But, like, this isn't the, like, Buttermaker's a frickin' bastard and, like, his relationship with his daughter, who is also one of the leads of the film, is front and center. That, like, generational tension in the first one had me be like, what kind of a household did Tanner come from? And a lot of that sort of stuff is sort of absent, even with like when they get to Texas, there's a lot of like homophobic slurring. And you see, you see not just players making it, but also some of the adults.
Yeah, the coach.
But because it's not as centered in the narrative as it kind of is in the first one, there's like all of this stuff here, but it doesn't feel like it's serving a purpose in the way that it that it is more so in the first film.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I sort of felt like with the homophobic slurs, at least those are the antagonists. So at least it's sort of like homophobia is a bad thing, right?
Sure.
Is different than if it's like, haha, this little kid who's on our team, we love him. He's so offensive. Yeah. Isn't that adorable?
And he's saying mean things to us despite everything we've already been through.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah,
exactly. On a different subject, but also picking up something that you were just talking about. What was the moment that it really sunk into your consciousness that Kelly Leak's dad's name is Mike Leak? I know there's no E on the end of the names of the Leaks in this film, but his dad's name is Mike Leak. Like, and this made me think, how often have there been characters that coincidentally share names with baseball players after the fact? And I'm not even sure that this is the first time that we've encountered this on the podcast. I feel like I maybe slightly remember talking about it, but I can't think of the other times off the top of my head. Anyway.
You know that one of the baseballs that we have there was that Mike Leak threw to me.
100%. Yeah. You had a personal encounter with Mike Leak.
Baseball, Mike Leak. It wasn't like I met William Devane at like a con and, yes. he gave it to me.
Yes. Yeah. Baseball, Mike Leak threw Eric a baseball one time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That was nice of him to do.
It was so nice of him. Thanks, Mike Leak. I really like, on the greater subject of Mike Leak's character, the fictional Mike Leak, I like that Mike's way of doing things is sort of affable and indirect and very, yeah. very smart. Like, he doesn't start yelling at the kids about what they're doing wrong. He's like, let's go to lunch, you know? He doesn't go straight up to someone and yell about the El Paso team taking the Bears place. He kind of sidles in, you know, nice day, isn't it?
Yeah.
And there are obviously so many ways in which his absence has formed Kelly. But there's also this through line on their intelligence and their ability to work a situation and their ability to kind of play somebody else that I thought was just an interesting through line, an interesting way in which, like, Kelly on the surface maybe doesn't totally seem like Mike's son, but the more that you think about it, the more it makes sense.
Yeah, and there's something as well that I feel like is kind of lovely that the movie does in terms of Kelly being a leader, and then that bridges into Mike leading them. In that they've been on this fantasy trip, right, where they've pulled off ruse after ruse, right? They get rid of the mean coach. They replace him. They get money. They get a van. They talk their way into hotels. Like, all of these adults are like unsuspecting dummies that they can just get the better of. And then they suddenly come to this point where, oh, they actually do need help navigating the world. They need somebody to smooth things over with the police, with like a nice man-to-man chat and like a promise of like tickets to the game. When they meet Cy Orlansky, the Budweiser guy who's like promoting the entire thing, who almost, like, the Bad News Bears, we haven't talked about this, they miss their early practice. They almost get replaced. And Cy Orlansky, he doesn't care. He just wants a team there. This is a commercial venture. This is a commercial venture. Welcome to 1977. This is the world of the film. Until they get some press. And then suddenly, he's more and more interested in it. And like, William Devane had a hand in all of this. He glad hands and talks and makes sure that Tanner gives Cy another beer. Like, he helps navigate this like adult part of the world that is still like very foreign to these kids. And so the way that he kind of like picks this up and like in a sort of like bemused fashion helps guide them through the end of the film. I was sort of bummed that the road movie part had ended, but I thought it was kind of wonderful, actually.
Yeah.
Like, despite the wonderful fantasy of the first half of the film, the fantasy does kind of, I don't want to say come to an end, because we do get the wonderful like finale of it, but like they actually do need adults in their lives. And I think that that is one of the main things thematically that happens with Kelly and Mike's relationship too. He's a rebel. He can do it all on his own. You talking to me, I'm going to drive my motorcycle with my tasseled leather jacket all over the place. Like all of that stuff. But like, he still kind of realizes that like his dad can be this like positive presence in his life, even now, even after what's happened, even if, as Mike says to him when they try to bury the hatchet, like, look, I know that like we're kind of like strangers right now, but like I'm here to help, like that, whatever that speech was.
Yeah. You know, it's, you're so smart, and I think you're absolutely right. And what I was sort of percolating on is the fact that for me, the thing about this film is that it is also like 2023 Blake Snell. This is in reference to the amount of baseball comp that I gave in part one.
Blake Snell, winner of the 2023 Warren Spahn Award.
Yes,
by the
exactly.
Way.
Yes. So for me, from the moment that William Devane enters the movie gets good. And I feel like stupid people who think they're smart will say something like Devane's performance saves the movie. And he's great. But to me, that's ignoring the fact that structurally and content-wise, I think the film just gets way, way better from there. I actually do not care for the on-the-road portion of this movie. Mm. I do not care for the how do we replace the coach portion of the movie.
Okay.
I mean, I think it is fine. Like, it's a fine version of that thing. But I actually think that part of the sort of confusion about, like, does this movie rock? Is that I think the second half of the movie rocks. And I think the first half of it does not. And,
okay.
And like, there aren't as many plot holes. There aren't, like, maybe as many offensive moments. And I just think that there are scenes and there are moments that are truly great. The ball game is great.
It really is.
And I think that the father-son story is so compelling. And yes, I think maybe some of that is about the acting performance between William Devane and Jackie Earle Haley, that they're so good, that their scenes are so good. But I also think that they're written better than anything that's in the first half of the movie.
Yeah.
And, you know, I do think that, like, the first time we watched the film, the father-son fight at practice kind of came out of nowhere for me. And I still think it might be helpful to have focused on shots of Kelly before the scene that are more about him reckoning with his dad, suddenly buying everybody lunch, like,
right,
suddenly saving the day with the Budweiser guy that he's grateful, but he's also like, where was this guy all of my life?
Yeah.
And maybe
it does come across decently for me, but I hear you.
I saw it better the second time when I already knew what happened. And it didn't read for me the first time. I don't know. One thing is, I feel like maybe the scene in the hotel room where he's looking out at the Astrodome telegraphs something different. Like, you can tell something's on his mind and you're like, oh, I guess maybe this is just about the game. And if we knew more about that he was introspective about his dad in that scene, I think it might help. But I mean, I think that this film's treatment of the father and the son relationship is really great. Like, I think that scene in the pool hall where somehow magically Mike knows exactly where to find Kelly, like, it underlines that Mike can't just buy Kelly's love, like, not with the bicycle or with helping out the team either. And it doesn't let him off the hook. And it doesn't let Kelly off the hook either for his behavior. And I just think it's actually very grown up for the movie to do.
Sure.
Right? Like, the movie's treatment of the father-son relationship is grown up. And I sort of feel like the first half of the movie is a kid's movie. And the second half of the movie is, I don't want to say like an adult movie, not even with the like quotation marks around adult. But like, one of the things that I was thinking, I promise I'm bringing this back around to your thought, was, oh, am I just a grown up?
Oh, yeah.
And that's why I like the second half of the movie, and I don't much care for the first half of the movie, right?
I felt that a little bit. I felt that at the beginning when I was like, oh, Kelly shouldn't be riding his bike all over that baseball field. That's not good. You're not going to be able to play on it. Oh, man, you're just making work for that sweet man.
Yeah, like all of the times when we're like, oh, no, we side with the grown-ups in the movie now.
Yeah. The game is fun. There's the batting order stuff that we talked about that's a little bit weird. But there's some good ups and downs. The fact that it almost gets called and then doesn't because Tanner, who was the one who wanted to practice at the very beginning, the one who just like really, really like cares, the one who's inspired by Newt Rockne All-American, and then him evading the guards and like all of this leading to Bob Watson yelling the now iconic "Let the kids play," which, by the way, also leads to Mike Leake starting a chant of "Let them play," in which not only does Kelly let his dad help there, he joins his dad and the two of them get the chant going, is beautiful. It's really, really lovely.
Yeah.
I do have a little bit of a quibble that it's a 4-inning game and it's after the second inning that they're like, we're out of time, when the first two innings went by very quickly. So like there is some bad scheduling going on at the Astrodome that like it seemed like if anything, they would maybe be ahead of schedule.
Yeah. Yeah. The team official coming in and stopping the game by saying, you didn't play it fast enough. And Mike responding, play what fast enough? A game is a game. I was like, you're dang right, MLB.
It's true, but it was like we saw a lot of like not exactly like 1-2-3 baseball, but like kind of.
Right. Yeah.
Like it wasn't like, oh, you know, the first inning lasted 45 minutes, so we've got to cut it short or something. Like they kind of zipped by. This wasn't like a, well, if Kelly hadn't had that 22 pitch at bat and like everybody was like throwing to first all the time. Like it wasn't a slowly paced two innings, right? So that was a little bit odd, but I do think that it is really lovely. And I think there's something nice about Carmen actually like coming into his own, even though it doesn't totally make sense for him to be hitting there, sort of to come in and hit that.
He was going to have to hit.
Well, but we just like hadn't seen him hit before.
Oh, yeah, so, yeah, no, so batting order problems, yes, there, for sure.
Swinging all those bats around, which is funny because that's also kind of like mimicking, you know, professional baseball
player. He was swinging like four bats also. It was amazing.
Fun fact, Ty Cobb is sometimes credited with being the first dude to like swing two bats around, which is like a funny thing, but it was done since early times. Like there's an 1897 article in the Chicago Inter-Ocean crediting early baseball pioneer and super legend Harry Wright with the practice. And I think he stopped playing like in the 1870s. And I thought this was very funny because never to be outdone, Ty Cobb in his memoirs of 20 years in baseball says that he was the one who improved on the idea and began the practice of swinging three bats. This was all from a book by Peter Morris called A Game of Inches, by the way.
Speaking of Ty Cobb, is the implication that the Toro kid slid hard into second base and hit Tanner in the shin?
Yeah, he spiked him.
Yeah, it's not what actually happens in the shot. I like rewatched it like 12 times, but obviously that's just making sure that the kids aren't actually injured.
Yeah,
but
yeah, I think the story being told is that he got spiked.
He was trying the hard slide, which is, you know, pretty on brand for the 1970s, I guess.
And Mike doesn't coddle him, which is not like he kind of talks to him like an adult.
Yeah.
In a way that actually oddly makes Tanner sort of like open up in a kind of like boyish way. And it's a very sweet moment, actually.
Yeah, it is a very sweet moment. I also think it's really perfect at the end of those first two innings that Kelly is out at the plate because Mike told him to go.
Yeah.
Right? It's a perfect everybody's fault moment. And it's also a perfect like, oh no, if the game ends now, Kelly will be holding on to further resentment that he didn't even get to score a run for his team.
Yeah.
Because of his dad. But yeah, I mean, the moment that you were talking about earlier when Tanner is running around evading the stadium crew, it's the clear standout of the film.
Yeah.
And I think it is ultimately quite a lovely moment, Mike chanting, "Let them play." But he also chants by himself for an excruciatingly long amount of time before Kelly comes to save him.
Yeah. And is joined by Cy and Officer mm-hmm. Mackey, which also, like, it's like these are the two adults that we know who are at the game. Like, some of it's just that kind of basic storytelling. But it also kind of had me feel like
hotel owner there too.
The hotel owner. I don't know. It felt a little bit to me like you see this like work that Mike did, like sort of paying off and sort of like talking his talk and getting the kids to where they need to be, but also doing it in such a way that like he left the officer and he left Cy with them being allies rather than like antagonists.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think another really nice moment of seeing one of the players learn, but also seeing that Mike had a positive effect is the way that Ahmad learns from his first at bat, because Mike yells something to him to like look at a couple of pitches and he doesn't. He just hits the first pitch. Yeah. And then the second at bat, he's like, "No, I'm going to watch a couple pitches go by."
Which, by the way, get called for strikes and they're like at his head.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. They are not strikes.
Man, man, oh man. Yeah. Yeah. Really rough. I don't know. I think I'm a 60 with this.
Oh, interesting. I think I am.
I will add the caveat that a lot of the weird, like, tons of 70s stuff, like, how so much of the era is just, like, represented by and sort of weirdly crammed into it, I am choosing to see as a feature and not a bug.
Sure, 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 sure. Yeah, I sort of had this thought where I'm like, I feel like the first half of the movie is a 40 and the back half of the movie is like a 60.
Okay.
And where does that leave me? I think I'm going to go 55. I think it's better than a 50. I think that this, though there are a lot of things to groan about in this movie, I think that it ends up being very enjoyable, right? Like, yeah. And in some ways, if you can just stick it out through the first half of the movie, better to have the second half be really enjoyable than have like so much promise in the first half of a movie and then have the second half crater.
And bear in mind that I was someone who actually quite enjoyed the first half of the movie. But some of that is because, well, number one, I think that we both went into this with pretty low expectations. And I was really charmed by just like the weirdness of it. Mm-hmm. I think it's a pretty weird movie.
It is a pretty weird movie.
But I dug it.
Yeah. So we're going to move along to our next tool, which is delightfulness of catcher character. And I feel like since we have not discussed it so far, we should discuss that Engelberg was replaced from the first movie. Apparently the original actor, Gary Lee Cavagnaro, had lost a lot of weight after making the first film, and the bad news powers that be determined, no, we must have our fat catcher and our fat jokes. And so they recast him with...
The book that I read suggested that Cavagnaro was given the opportunity to like become large again, and he was like, no, thank you. there wasn't like a source to it or whatever, but that was sort of what the book implied.
Interesting. Yeah.
But instead we get this new guy,
and it's tough because we've already graded the delightfulness of the idea of Engelberg the catcher, but I think that the character is less delightful in this film. This is not the actor's fault. I just felt that the jokes about him eating and going to the bathroom were more relentless in this film than they were in the first one.
Yeah, we see him on the toilet once and he's eating Kentucky Fried Chicken, which he orders first thing when they arrive at the hotel. And then I think twice while they're on the road, he's the one who asks to stop.
I think maybe even three times.
Yeah. Well, fat boy's got to poop. That's the story.
Yeah.
That's the story. Apparently, he was discovered at a Kentucky Fried Chicken.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it's not great. And, like, I think I may have a slight preference for the actor in the first one, but...
I think I do, too.
But he's really reduced to mostly just being a fat kid in the second one. There are, you know, some things that he does, but, like, you know, the game against the Native American team, he mostly just says, throw it in, as he helplessly watches Carmen get, like, bombed when it's, like, 5-0 with no outs in the bottom of the first. There's that moment that he argues balls and strikes with the Houston umpire. He doesn't get tossed. That's nice.
Yeah. Yeah, sure.
That'd be really funny if he'd got thrown out.
Actually quite comical.
Aside from that, we do get a couple of other kind of catcher moments, right? Like, William Devane kind of is a catcher a little bit when he's, like, helping Carmen out. And so that's not nothing. And then we also get the Toros catcher who, like, when Tanner comes up to bat, he says, give him a toothpick, aim at my shoelaces, which is that interesting thing that happens in a sports movie sometimes where I was like, when that happened, I was like, I don't know, I might think that was pretty funny if he was my catcher, but he's not, so
but he's
I hate
not,
him.
So I hate him, yes. Yeah.
And also, just real quick, is when Feldman comes up, goes, got one of the Marx Brothers up here, which is a very funny inside joke because the role is played by Brett Marx, who is the grandson of Gummo Marx.
Oh my gosh, no way. I did not know that. Oh, that is hilarious.
Yeah.
Oh, that's really good.
He looks like a Marx brother because he is a blood
He's
relation
He's a Marx
to them.
Grandson, as
yeah.
a matter of fact.
Yeah.
But, yeah. You know, I think that the Toro catcher is actually the same kid that Kelly sort of gets into a confrontation with,
he
right?
Is.
Like,
yeah.
Like, he's the most adversarial of all of the Toro players that we get
and
to meet.
I think that he's the one who, when he scores a run in the game, does a little, like, jig and then, like, pats Engelberg on the cheek, like, really, like, rubs it in his face.
He's a real jerk.
This umpire needs to be better at his job.
Yeah. He was clearly just like, I'm not throwing any of these kids out.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. 100%. 100%.
Yeah. So I feel like with the sort of detractions from the enemy catcher and, you know, the fact that if a catcher is supposed to be either comedic relief or the lovable team leader, I don't think Engelberg really does either in this film.
Yeah.
It's the writing's fault that I didn't think any of his jokes were funny. So I'm a 45.
I also have 45.
I could see going 40, but...
Yeah, he does make that first coach think his name is Elton John.
He does. That's true.
Sick burn. Yes. Or like, yeah, you really pulled the wool over his eyes.
Oh,
whatever.
I guess it's a joke. What about delightfulness of announcer?
There is the Astros announcer announcing like the beginning of the game and the various players when they come to bat, but that's pretty much it, right?
He says a few other things. Like if there's a big play, he's like, that's a 2-run home run. He recaps the scores at the end of the inning. So he's doing more than a stadium in-game announcer would do for the purposes of the storytelling of the film.
Right. And it's not like people are like listening to it on the radio or something. So he's calling it over the loudspeakers in a kind of basic way. It's not nothing, but barely. I mean, 30 pretty easily.
Agreed. Yes. Let's move along to our final tool, which is lack of misogyny. This film takes a huge step back from the first film, just in terms of representation. Without the character of Amanda and without the female league manager, the only woman who is not some kind of a love interest or a hooting at interest or a mom in the dinner montage mm-hmm. is the hotel manager, and she freaking yeah. rocks. I love her, and thank God for her, but she appears in like 3 scenes. About the scene with the female hitchhiker.
Uh-huh.
I do understand why the, like, let's be frank, smoking hot female hitchhiker, decides not to get in the van with all of those tween and teenage boys. Just primed on looking at Playboys.
We're literally writhing around inside of the van.
Yes.
In a horny, giggly fit.
Yes. But she also, with the first time that we watched the movie, she exudes confidence that suggested to me that she could have easily handled herself. Let me be clear, in the universe of this movie.
Yeah.
And I was sorry we didn't see a version of the film where she became an actual character, if only for a few scenes, and not just a kind of a punchline. Like, seriously, none of them would have known what to do with her. It would have been funny if they were all catcalling her and then cut to a scene where she's just sitting shotgun and they're all quiet and stunned because they don't know what to do, right?
Yeah.
And this is, none of this is to underestimate the damage that can be done by an entire pack of teenage boys. But I just feel like the world of Bad News Bears is one that I think actually needs a tough, smart woman who takes no shit from the boys. So when she ran away, in a real life situation, I would be like, good. But in the reality of this film, I was like, oh, I thought maybe she was going to be a character. And I was disappointed. Yeah.
Yeah, there's not much to speak of. And most of what's there is either like mom types or provocatively dressed objects of fantasy, much like the women in the Playboys that Carmen gets.
Yes. I also do not love the fact that in the scene when Kelly and Mike meet, that it's Mike's girlfriend who has to be so insensitive and need to get where she's going. Right. Like, she's just a superficial woman who doesn't care about her boyfriend's estranged son. She only cares about herself.
Also, she drives to pick up Mike from work, immediately gets out of the car and sits shotgun because it is the man who needs to do the driving.
Yes. Also that. And then she completely disappears from the film because her obstructive story function is over.
Yeah, she's not at the game. She's not, I mean, like, this would have been misogynistic, but like, she's not there to help take them out to lunch or bring them a snack.
She literally disappears.
No,
she doesn't go to the game on Sunday. Yeah.
Yeah, that's very, very strange. But meanwhile, like, Cy and Officer Mackey both have like hot chicks galore next to them.
Oh my God, which does not count as positive female representation.
No. And then also one moment in the van, the boys are all singing a song together, this version of a song called Was It You? That I know has been recorded, but the recordings that I've seen are actually a number of years after this moment. So I think it's just like one of those songs that kids sing that have been around for a while. And the content of the song is a man asking like his daughter's boyfriend, did you sleep with my daughter? And he's like, yes, but she gave me an STI, so we're even, is basically like the content of the song. So even in the like jolly singing along the road, they like found a way to put in like a little more misogyny.
Yep. Yeah, totally. And the first time we meet the girls who are hanging out with the Toros, the one of them who takes a liking to Ogilvy, some kids on the Bears shout, looky, looky at them, which is maybe accurate, but not endearing. I do want to briefly mention that scene. We didn't talk about it in storytelling. I mean, in some ways,
Ogilvy as scout.
Oh, Ogilvy as scout. I loved that scene.
Yeah.
And I recognize it for like a certain amount of maybe wish fulfillment, but I don't know. Like, I can't remember if I said in our first podcast or not, but like, if I were 12 years old and I knew these people, Ogilvy is the one that I would like.
I kind of like that these hot Texas girls are like kind of into the stats guy.
Yeah, and I mean,
it's probably also because he's like tall, but like...
Yeah, it never hurts. I felt like it was supposed to be like, oh my God, isn't it hilarious that they like him? And I'm like, no, he's the one that I would like.
Yeah.
So, I mean, granted, on a surface level at 12, I was nothing like the young woman pictured in this film. But like, why the heck not?
Fun anecdote. That actor, I think his name's Arthur Lutter III. He had a, you know, very promising acting career. He was good in these movies. He was in Alice Doesn't Live Here Anymore, which is like another like classic film from earlier in the 70s, also a road movie. And he like went to Stanford and like he started like a tech advising company. And so like,
I love that.
Isn't that awesome?
I love that so much. Yes.
So he's been like a kind of like a Silicon Valley guy since, I mean, I think like since like the 80s.
Wow. Yeah. Mr. Professor. Anyway, in terms of lack of misogyny, it's hard, man. There's not a lot to counterbalance the fact that all of the female characters are very small, like not the kind of character who even gets a name. Yeah. And with what we do get, there's objectification and there's negative stereotyping. I'm going to go 30. I think it might be a 20 without the hotel manager.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
But I think it's a 30. I don't think it's a 20. And I also think that like what exists is actually not quite as bad in terms of some of the like storytelling messaging than some of the other bad lack of misogyny films that we have seen in our days. But I don't think it's better than the 30.
Yeah, I dig the hotel employee as well. I like that she just assumed that it was a bunch of little people and is like, why are you making trouble for these little people? Like, I enjoyed that. It was a fun twist on the sort of like ruse thing going on. And also a little bit of its like intention. Some movies we see like a kind of meaner spirited misogyny than I think is what's in play here. This I think is a kind of dated thing of like, this was clearly conceived as a movie about boys, young boys for young boys. And like, there's something that's like really not great about that, but I don't know that it was like intending harm. I think it was trying to be the cinematic equivalent of like a kid sneaking a look at the Playboy. And
yeah.
And there's enough sort of like innocence and like mystery about women in it as well that I think that helps counteract it a little bit. I don't mean to forgive any of it because I have 20 question mark, 30 question mark written on my score. But with all of that and what you were just talking about, like I think I'm perfectly happy to also have it be a 30.
Great. So this concludes our scoring of The Bad News Bears in Breaking Training. And now we just have some other questions to answer in our next segment entitled Yes or No. Would this movie be better with Kevin Costner in it?
I mean, Mike Leake, I mean, I guess he could be, I think he could be good in it. I don't know that he'd be as good as William Devane. I think that, like, there's a certain kind of, like, blue-collar energy that I just, like, wonder if it would, like, look as fit Costner as comfortably as it seems to.
100% agree.
For Devane.
Yep.
And if he doesn't fit that role, but he has to go somewhere, like, I can give, like, jokey answers. There's, you know, any number of, like, be the groundskeeper or whatever.
It would be actually sort of hilarious if he was the groundskeeper. I don't think it would be great casting, but, like, knowing everything that we know, if Kevin Costner's baseballness, like, was inserted into this movie, great joke casting.
Yeah, but if it were, like, an honest, non-jokey type of thing, I think probably the best fit for him, it wouldn't be making use of his talents, so you'd maybe need to expand it a little bit more or like whatever, maybe not, is I think he could be the Toro's coach. And like, I feel like that would make a certain amount of sense and be interesting. But again, I'm not like, I'm not sold on it. So it's a qualified yes in that respect.
I don't know. I don't know that he just feels like evil enough. I feel like you'd miss that Toro's manager and his like Ricky Gervais teeth.
Fair enough.
Yeah. Does this movie reference Babe Ruth?
I don't think it does.
No, it does not. Is there a dog?
I don't think there is.
There's no dog. What about Yankees fans? Are they the main antagonist of this film?
No.
Yeah. Yet another thing that was better about the first film was the affirmative answer to this question.
Yeah.
Was this also, this is another no. Even Astros fans aren't an antagonist, which is something many of us could get behind.
It's like the Toros. It's like society. It's like any number of things, but it is definitely not the Yankees.
Yeah.
Or their fans.
What about 6 degrees of baseball? You sort of, well, you kind of had one earlier.
Yes and no, I guess, just because like, but the thing is like, we don't actually get any Gipper scene in this.
It's true.
So, and also it's like a movie within a movie. So that would be
I think it would
a
count
little, okay.
If we saw Ronald Reagan, but we don't.
Future reference sake, that's good to know. But I felt comfortable bringing that up, even if you would have challenged me on it, even if there had been some Gipper footage. Because the thing is, Lane Smith, who plays Officer Mackey, you may remember, you may have blocked it from your memory, plays Yankees front office guy Ron in the 1994 really bad movie, The Scout.
I had blocked it from my memory.
Yeah, no, he's in The Scout.
I had blocked it. I'd blocked it completely. And I was actually thinking of the director as being the 6 degrees of baseball, not Ronald Reagan.
Yeah, yeah. Well, but that would be a 6 degrees between like a couple of other movies. Like, because this director didn't direct another baseball movie.
Oh, I thought he did. I thought you said he did. You can erase all of this.
Yeah. No, he didn't.
Okay.
I'll listen for, maybe I phrased it in a confusing way.
I thought, yeah, I don't know why I thought that that you said that the director of the Newt Rockne movie had also directed a baseball movie. I don't know why that.
He had, but that is different from the director of this movie. The Newt Rockne All-American director also directed It Happens Every Spring and Kill the Umpire.
Yeah, I think that would count as a 6 degrees of baseball.
Okay. I disagree, but doesn't matter.
Can I just say a brief version of this?
Mm-hmm.
And what I meant earlier was just that the director of Newt Rockne had also directed baseball movies. That's what I was referring to as like a possible 6 degrees of baseball, but you came up with a much better one.
We have much more fruitful offerings.
So, speaking of fruitful offerings, what was your favorite moment of this film?
Well, there's actually a lot to choose from for me, whether it is the endearing scenes but where the leaks kind of hash it out, which I think is some really, really good acting. It could be the first time that we watched the movie together and Jackie Earle Haley was looking all cool and lighting up. And you said, quote, "It's so unfortunate that cigarettes look so cool." That was a good moment.
I don't remember saying that, so thank you for memorializing it.
I really like how Miguel is wearing a shirt that says, "Los osos de las malas noticias." Like he has...
Will you please translate that for...
The Bad News Bears.
Oh.
But just in Spanish on his shirt. I think that's like a really, really funny costume choice.
Oh, that's hilarious.
But I think I'm going to go with... There really is a lot to choose from because I'm just like fascinated by this film. I did not particularly enjoy the book that I read on it, but I totally understand why someone wrote a book on it. And the person also was like a kid when the movie came out, so it's got like all of that on top of it too. I really like in the game with the Native American team when Tanner gets out after the ball like bounces off of the big stone that is kind of acting as third base when he storms off and goes, "Take away your rock and you got nothing." I think that line is so funny and might be my favorite line of the movie. And so I'm just going to have that be my favorite scene. Great. And maybe by extension, that game, because that was also a really interesting thing I could choose. But really, I'm thinking about that line.
Yeah. Yeah. I for me, I feel like Tanner evading the stadium officials is the clear showstopper of this film. But I am going to pick something that we have not talked about yet, which is that long shot where all the boys are running in and out of the different hotel rooms. It's incredible.
Oh, yeah.
It starts with some kind of like Steadicam movie tracking back down the hallways from them pouring out of the elevator. And I have to feel like it took a half day to rehearse with PAs and all the hotel rooms, cueing the kids about exactly when to go into the hallway and like which doors to run to. And I mean, I say that, but I also feel like there's a 1% chance that the director was just like, okay, everybody know their lines and who they're going to talk to and just come out excited and run between the hotel rooms and let's see what happens. And like, it just ended up being magical just because the kids' joy is so organic in that scene.
Yeah.
Like it feels, something about the energy in that scene feels more like the energy of the first film. And like, it just doesn't feel rehearsed, even if it was rehearsed for an entire half of a day.
And, good choice.
Yeah. And I actually just think like it's a really great filmmaking moment. And it's also possible that maybe, you know, I don't know what the shooting schedule was like. Maybe a little bit more rehearsal could have benefited the kids in some of the scenes, but they were kind of like, no, we just need you to come up and say your line and leave. And like, so maybe this was rehearsed a bunch and that's why like the kids were kind of able to get into it more. Anyway, just a thought. What about your least favorite moment?
I mean, it's like the easy no-brainer choice, but just like all of the like super duper like culturally insensitive stuff is just like, I mean, the like peace pipe scalping, like all of that stuff is like what kind of makes it a little tough at point. Not horrible, but like it does make you wince when it happens, especially because like not to say that it's perfectly fine in the first movie, but in the first movie it just sort of felt like it was at least like serving a purpose that it is not serving here.
Yeah, or I, because for me it's also it's specifically the like we've been scalped joke, I think has to be my number one least favorite moment. And I think, you know, we've talked a little bit about the issues that we have, the almost like meta issues that we have with Tanner using so many offensive epithets. But I think I understand that the film is trying to make a joke by creating a dichotomy between this cherubic looking child and the vitriol that he spits. But I feel like this moment, the we've been scalped moment, is just meant to be a joke. It's not meant to be like, look at the kid being offensive. It's just supposed to be a joke. Yeah. It's just supposed to be a button to the scene. It's a little bit more like the sequence about ticket scalping in Porky's baseball broadcast.
Right.
Right? Like, right. Like, oh, do you even know that this is super offensive? Right?
Yeah. And it's this weird, like, insulting thing to say to, like, a team that just, like, kicked your teeth in. Like, rather than them genuinely being like humbled by the experience, it's like a way to sort of like shrug it off.
Totally. Yeah.
And yeah, that they should have found a different joke.
Yep. It's gross. Moving on. What about a scene you'd like to see?
Well, obviously I'd like to see more of that native team. Mm. Like, why aren't they at the Astrodome? Like, why? Like, I don't know.
Resources.
I thought that would have been great. I could have dealt with a little more road tripping or just like more adventures within that, even if it took the same amount of time. It just seemed like I found it to be such a like rich premise that it felt like they left a lot on the table. I don't know that the concept was like, I felt like there was more room to explore that premise, and I would have liked to see more of that. Also, get Tatum O'Neill for a day or two, have Amanda come in for like one or two like killer scenes. I get that she's not there, but even more than Buttermaker, I wanted her character to be a presence, ideally in person, even if it's just to like, you know, the movie starts with her quitting the team and then they've got to like solve this problem, or just some reference that she existed rather than we need a picture.
Yep. Yes, you picked more than one scene that you'd like to see, and so thus you stole my scene that I'd like to see.
Oh, I'm sorry.
No, it's fine. Which is just, where the heck is Amanda? Like, Timmy Lupus gets the whole film made about him, and we don't even learn what Amanda is up to?
Have Amanda be the person with the broken leg.
Yeah, I got the feeling that this is probably because Tatum O'Neill was like, no thank you to doing this film.
I would bet almost any amount.
But if I can just ask for like a scene I'd like to see.
Yeah.
That's what I'm going to ask for.
I think that's good. Who do you think is the dreamiest?
Well, imagining myself at 12 years old, where this isn't creepy. Now, the first film I picked Amanda, which I think is obvious.
Uh-huh.
But for this one, it is maybe tougher. Like, as discussed, Ogilvy is dreamy in his way. To the Texan girl and to people for whom baseball nerds are their type. But I think, for me, it ends up being Shohei Jabroni, Carmen Ronzani.
Yeah,
you know,
hey,
because
he does that Bayo family proud.
Yeah, like, this kid gets an inside the Parker and he pitches okay once he drops the windup stuff, right? Like, Shohei Jabroni. And he's obviously a huge baseball nerd. You know what I mean? This kid loves baseball.
Yeah.
I love that about him. That's a very attractive quality.
I think that's a good choice.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, and with Kelly right there, too.
Yeah, I get that he would be some people's dreamiest player, but just like, I think he's more talented than passionate about the game. He's not my type.
True, true. I could fix him.
No. No, I don't know.
I've never You know that Carmen is so much more fun to hang out with.
Oh my God, obviously.
Yeah.
Obviously. Yeah, no, I think I've never really been the fixer upper type.
And you know that since Carmen embodies so many Italian stereotypes. Like, he's got like
his mom's got to be a great cook.
Yeah, he's got a nonna who's very sweet. Like, yeah, yeah. You could probably like walk the streets safe at night because like he knows people who will look after you. Like, it's win, 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 win.
It's yeah. Obviously Carmen. What about your favorite performance?
I was really torn between Jimmy Bayo and Jackie Earle Haley. I'm going to go Jackie Earle Haley.
You know, different strokes for different folks.
Well, I think it's very much his movie, you know, and I think that his journey kind of like represents what the movie is about the most. This like searching for freedom, trying to find some like reconciliation with his dad, trying to be a leader. I think he's great. He's given a lot to do, of course, but like I think that he like lives up to it, and I think that he manages to be very like grounded and believable, even as he's asked to kind of like put on this patchwork quilt of various tropes and kind of like navigate the movie as it becomes a different kind of movie, and then becomes another different kind of movie, and I think that's really cool. But I think Jimmy Bayo is like a very close second for me.
What about your favorite performance?
Wait, what about you? Is it Bayo for you? You didn't give a favorite performance.
Oh, sorry. I thought that was, or I saw this. I thought that was your dreamiest player.
No.
That was your favorite performance.
Yeah, I thought you said favorite performance.
I did, and I just stroked out.
So what about you? What's your favorite performance?
This is maybe a controversial take.
Uh-huh.
I know I usually try to avoid this, but it's freaking Jimmy Bayo in this film. I just think he's great. Like, William Devane is probably the best performance, followed by Jackie Earle Haley. But yeah. I just enjoy Jimmy Bayo. I feel like everything he says, he means. I feel like his joy is real. His disappointment is real. His embarrassment is real. And this might have been a directorial choice or in the script, but when he first appears and chooses to hop over the fence, even though the opening to the fence is literally right next to him to walk through, I was like, yeah. An amazing choice. So great. I was also very delighted to learn this biographical fact about Jimmy, that he is the cousin of actor Scott Bayo and Vampire Weekend band member Chris Bayo, and he is also the cousin of Major League Baseball player Harrison Bader.
What?
Yes.
Harrison Bayo.
Yes. You can kind of see it if you decide you want to.
Oh, wow. That's wild.
Yeah. Yeah.
Love it.
I love it so much. So thank you so much for joining us for our discussion of the Bad News Bears in Breaking Training. If you enjoyed this podcast, please rate and review us over at PitcherList, where we could very much use your kind reviews, having lost all of our previous ratings and reviews.
Yeah, we need reviews, please. Please, sir, can I have a review?
And next time, we are going to be doing the film Baseball Girl, a Korean movie, which I have been interested in for a long time, but there was no way to procure it in the United States.
Only recently become available legally to watch in the U.S. It has only recently been allowed, it's a 2020 film, but I think it's super recent that it's been available to like rent and purchase here. It's been like on our radar for a while, so we're really excited to look at it.
Yes. And if you would like to find us on the internets between now and then, you can find me on Twixter at Ellen_Adair, Blue Sky, and let me just start again. I know it's so annoying. If you would like to find us on the internets between now and then, you can find me on Twixter at Ellen_Adair. I'm on TikTok and Blue Sky at Ellen Adair. I am on Instagram and Threads at Ellen Adair G.
And I am at Eric Gildy on some of those things.
But it's always Eric Gildy. The blessing of having a very unusual last name.
Yeah.
I mean, it's mine now, too. But
it's nice to be on top.
Yes. And we will... That's my husband, ladies and gentlemen, people of all genders. We will talk to you next time on Take Me Into the Ball Game.
Bye, guys!